Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Economic news isn't always neat and tidy, you know. Sometimes it's just a big ball of goo, and that leaves you trying to untangle what's real and what's not. Today on the broadcast, corporate profits and consumer intentions. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Nixon Peabody LLP, a full-service international law firm offering practical solutions for today's real-world business challenges. More at nixonpeabody.com. And by MassMutual, a mutual life insurance company owned by its members and policyholders. Learn more at massmutual.com/mutuality.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 18th of May. Good to have you with us. When you skim the headlines, it's easy to get just a partial picture of what the news really is. That goes for politics and the style section, and definitely it goes for business news. A lot of companies have had good things to say lately about first quarter profits. Just today, the world's biggest retailer, Walmart, reported a 10% jump in earnings, a record quarter, in fact. But the company also attached a note of caution to that announcement, saying its customers are still concerned about their personal finances. Other retailers have been raising similar red flags, so we asked our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, whether people ought to start worrying again.
The consumer is no longer in hiding. That was the confident assessment from the head of JCPenney the other day, but it was quickly tempered with this. They are being very pragmatic. The forecast from Penny's rival Kohl's and from Lowe's, the home improvement chain, has also been muted. At Urban Outfitters, on the other hand, CEO Glenn Senk was downright blunt.
I do not believe we are out of the woods. I am not optimistic about the nature of the economy. I think there are many positive signs, but I think this is going to be a slow and lengthy recovery. We are not overly confident about our business. I think we're doing a good job, but it's not easy.
But if profits are rising, why are retailers so glum? Doug Hart has been researching that question at the business consulting firm BDO. He says businesses are worried that credit is still tight and wages remain flat, which limits what consumers are able to spend.
The savings rate, which had been increasing for several months, has started to decline recently. And I guess the retailers look and say that can only go on for so long.
The fact consumers are spending some gives economist Joel Naroff hope they could be priming the economic pump. But unless it leads to more hiring soon, their spending could be tough to maintain.
We really need the middle-income households to be out there being comfortable about the future, having their confidence rise, having their wages rise, and spending.
Naroff says it underscores what economists have long cautioned, the recovery will be slow. And possibly slower still, he says, if it causes nervous retailers to hold back. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Along those lines, this was another triple-digit day for the Dow Industrials on the downside this time. Of course, a 100-point loss is better than that 1,000-point yo-yo the Dow took us on a week or two ago. The Securities and Exchange Commission is expected to announce new market rules sometime soon that will, hopefully, help prevent another flash crash. From Washington, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
The SEC is going to start its reforms with individual stock fluctuations and then move on to whole exchanges. First, trading in any one of the 500 biggest stocks would be programmed to stop if a stock rose or fell by 10% in 5 minutes. Lynn Turner is a former chief accountant at the SEC. He says when a stock hits that level,
then bam, it'll automatically kick in.
The SEC is expected to unveil the new rules for exchanges soon. They'll also apply to stock futures. During the flash crash, markets didn't have uniform circuit breakers. Each exchange had its own rules. Manual traders had one set of rules, and the electronic exchanges had another. And the Dow didn't fall quite far enough to trigger those existing circuit breakers. But there's a question about how much good any circuit breakers can really do. Ken Kuttner teaches economics at Williams College.
how do you design these circuit breakers in such a way that they have the desired effect of reducing volatility rather than, by stopping trading, making prices fall even further?
And prices can fall really far, really fast with electronic trading. Computerized trading systems are simply programmed to buy or sell at a certain price. They don't take a company's fundamental health into account. Rajiv Sethi is an economist at Columbia University. He says that's what's dangerous about these trades. They cause a lot of volatility.
This, to me, is a recipe for instability. If there's too many people trying to use prices to guess at where prices are going to go, you're going to have instability no matter what.
Sethi says automatic computer trading can cause a stampede of selling until circuit breakers kick in. A stock could go from, say, $40 to 1 cent a share in 20 minutes. That's what happened to Accenture during the flash crash. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The Senate has a key vote on financial reform scheduled for tomorrow. Senators are, of course, busy tacking on a stack of last-minute amendments to that bill. And one of them, in particular, got our attention about the International Monetary Fund. The IMF's been in the news lately for its role in that trillion-dollar European bailout package. The IMF ponied up a big chunk of that total. But senators now want it to stop lending to countries that can't pay the money back. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
The amendment would block the IMF from lending money to a country that probably couldn't pay it back, namely countries like Greece and Italy, whose debts exceed their annual incomes. Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas proposed the amendment. It passed unanimously.
The American people are suffering from bailout fatigue. It's one thing to do that for institutions here at home to keep our economy from tanking. They were not willing to do it for other countries.
The IMF is funded by member countries. The U.S. puts up about 17% of the money. Raghu Rajan is a former chief economist at the IMF.
Greece is a small country. Now, if Greece is too big to fail, then everybody, except perhaps poor Iceland, is too big to fail. At some point, we have to draw a line in the sand.
Rajan says countries like Greece need to restructure their debt and tackle their fundamental problems, not borrow billions more they can't repay. But Kenneth Rogoff, also former chief economist at the IMF, disagrees.
Europe is in trouble. This is not the time for the United States to be sending a signal. We're not going to help.
Rogoff says countries need the money for day-to-day operations while they figure out a long-term solution. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, nope, nuh-uh. Traders just didn't have it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation has taken over 72 failed banks so far this year. Chicago-based Shore Bank was set to become number 73, but the community lender is going to live to see another day thanks to some friends on Wall Street. A group that includes Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, and General Electric has ponied up the $125 million that Shore Bank needed to stay afloat. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now from New York that Goldman and the gang might be able to charge this particular effort to their public relations budgets.
You'd be forgiven if you've never heard of Shore Bank, but President Obama sure has. When he was a senator, he visited Kenya and promoted a Shore Bank microlending effort there.
We've been talking to the health minister and others to find out what we can do to create more businesses in this community.
So it sort of seems like the perfect PR move for a bunch of big investment banks that know what it's like to be bailed out to jump in and save Shore Bank in its time of need.
No, I don't think that's it.
Eugene Ludwig is CEO of Promontory Financial Group. He helped pool together the investors that are bailing out Shore Bank. He says the rescue is all in keeping with what he calls the big bank's tradition of civic responsibility.
This is an institution that's recognized by world figures all over the world, and for it to have failed would have been, I think, a blow not just to the Midwest and not just to the people at Shore Bank, but to U.S. prestige and leadership in this important area of global development.
It may also keep a lot of voters happy. Ronald Glantz chairs the financial services group at the Venable Law Firm in Washington. He says regardless of the bank's motivations for stepping in, if they hadn't, there would be a lot of low-income people with no access to cash.
And I think by saving the bank, you also save the small businesses and the borrowers who really don't have any place else to turn.
Glantz says it's a smart move for unpopular banks and an opportunity to show a skeptical public their good side, even if it might look a little obvious. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Given the state of the American housing industry, there is a lot to be said for not owning a home. For just being a tenant, you pay your rent, your landlord's responsible for maintenance, everything's fine. Except foreclosure can happen to tenants, too. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
There's no switch for the light in Etta Hillbank's bathroom. If you want to turn it off, you have to unscrew the fuse. Now, the fuse box is 10 or 12 feet up, almost where the wall hits the ceiling.
How do you climb up there?
Well, I have a ladder. I get on the ladder, then I get up here and do that.
That is, she climbs onto a table that's pushed up against the wall. It's a pretty impressive feat, especially when you consider she's 74 and she walks with a cane. She'd really like to get the light fixed, but it's not that simple.
There is a responsibility vacuum.
Jonathan Levy is a lawyer for Legal Services NYC Bronx. He's helping Hillbanks and her fellow tenants with a legal action. They want a judge to make somebody come up with the cash to repair the building.
The party that was initially responsible has essentially disappeared. That's the landlord.
The landlord is technically a real estate investment company in Los Angeles, a place called Milbank. It got a mortgage from Deutsche Bank, but Deutsche Bank packaged the mortgage into a mortgage-backed security trust, which it sold to Wells Fargo. Now, if that weren't complicated enough, the real estate company Milbank defaulted on the loan, and the property's in foreclosure. If you're totally confused about who's responsible, just imagine trying to figure out who to call about that light switch in your bathroom. In fact, Etta Hillbanks does have someone to call. It's the receiver. That's the person the court appointed to collect rent and keep the building up while it's in foreclosure. The problem is, the receiver says there's no money.
He did tell us that he doesn't have money to make major repairs and paint. And the only thing that he could do now was to give us heat and hot water and try to keep the elevator repaired and keep the building clean.
Jonathan Levy, the lawyer, says he doesn't care who's responsible.
We think somebody's got to come up with this money. It can't be the tenants are the ones who pay the price for this foolish gamble.
Ms. Hillbank's building is one of 10 the developer bought in the Bronx. Housing advocates guess it would cost several $1 million to fix the thousands of violations in the whole portfolio. Adam Levitin's a law professor at Georgetown University. He says the situation's not that different from a regular foreclosure.
While it's in foreclosure, the ownership of the building is basically not stable. There's no one who wants to take charge of the building while the foreclosure process is still pending.
All the parties involved, the landlord, the bank, the trustee, the special servicer, the receiver, say it's not their problem. That's what the judge has to decide. The hearing is scheduled for the middle of June, and Levy says it'll probably be several months before there's a ruling. And who knows how long it'll take before Etta Hillbanks can switch off her bathroom light like the rest of us. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Coming up, the seat of power in Silicon Valley.
We have a pirate flag hanging over the main war column, is what we call it. My desk is where Sergey Brin once sat, who is the co-founder of Google.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, same worries, just a different day. Anxiety over Europe and financial reform pushed the Dow Industrials down 1% today, 114 points, closed at 10,510. The NASDAQ gave back 1.5%, 36 points, finished at 2317. The S&P 500 forfeited 1.4%, 16 points, ended the day at 1120. Financial shares took a big hit. Goldman Sachs unloaded 3.2%. Citigroup reversed 3.3%. Bank of America withdrew nearly 2.5% today. Retailers had it rough, too. Home Depot forfeited nearly 2.5% despite reporting strong quarterly earnings. Abercrombie & Fitch lost nearly 6% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.35%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at Vanguard.com. And by CSX, working to reduce traffic and pollution while moving 1 million tons of freight daily. CSX, how tomorrow moves. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its Consumer Price Index for April. The National Trust for Historic Preservation announces its annual list of America's 11 most endangered historic places. And the Internet Security Alliance critiques cyber attacks depicted in the movies. What's fact and what's fiction? Some of it certainly is entertaining. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Seattle is the latest city to boycott Arizona. Kind of. The city council there last night approved the boycott to protest Arizona's tough new immigration law. But they managed to do it in a way that maintains the only substantive contract the city has with an Arizona company. It's $1.3 million to run Seattle's red light cameras, if you're curious. But even token protests like that can add up. Other cities have approved actual economic boycotts. So those who favor tougher immigration laws are fighting back, trying their best to support Arizona financially. Janet Babin reports.
Genevieve Peters vacationed in southern Nevada this past weekend, but the L.A. native also went out of her way to cross into Arizona.
We went over there and spent money. We filled up our gas tank and we ate breakfast before we traveled home.
Peters is what's called a boycotter. She uses her pocketbook to support Arizona's new immigration law. Los Angeles, Boston, and New York are among a growing list of entities boycotting Arizona because of the bill. Peter says they have no right.
Have you checked with the people? Have you taken a poll? No, you haven't.
Not only are some groups supporting the boycott, they're hoping 13 other states enact similar laws. Opponents of the bill say it could lead to racial profiling. It certainly led to funny comedy skits, like this one from Second City that features a Latino tourist running from the law.
Arizona, it's not for everybody.
From the Arizona Office of Tourism, come for the barren desert wasteland, stay for the hospitality.
That's the type of profiling Kristen Jarnigan with the Arizona Hotel and Lodging Association wants to avoid. The group's trying to put a face to the people the boycott impacts the most.
We have 200,000 people in our state employed by tourism. When people cancel meetings or they decide not to come, those people who are hurt the most are the hourly employees.
Jarnigan says the first goal is to stop the bleeding and prevent other cities from joining the boycott. Then the group will focus on the long-term challenge of getting tourists back to Arizona. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
There is a case to be made that the word sustainability is overused, that we all know we've got to do more to make how we live and how we work gentler on the planet and its people. There are sustainability initiatives, sustainability desks, and sustainability consulting firms. But Yale University's Dan Esty says a lot of companies still don't get it. He writes that sustainability is the latest corporate megatrend and businesses ignore it at their peril. Dan, it's good to have you here.
Thanks very much. A pleasure to be with you.
So, Dan, we all know, you know, what business trends are. What are these things you're calling megatrends?
So a business megatrend is something that transforms the competitive landscape, that so changes how businesses operate and what society is expecting from companies that anyone that doesn't pick up the trend is at risk of losing their position in the marketplace. And we've seen that play out with a number of issues in the past.
Like what?
Things like the information technology revolution, which started in the late 70s, even into the 80s, with a small set of big businesses finding ways to bring computer power to bear in their businesses. And over time, that spread through all kinds of companies, middle-sized companies, and eventually even small business. And we see the same thing happening now with sustainability. A leading set of big companies are really finding this as an important element of strategy because these core principles that sustainability is a societal value that's not going away, that care in how you spend money on energy, what you use in the way of resources, how much waste and scrap you have in production, are aspects of what can give you a leading edge position in the marketplace.
Well, give me an example. If I am, say, Alan Mulally running Ford Motor Company, and I've read your article in the Harvard Business Review, and I said, man, this Dan Esty guy, he's really onto something. What should he do?
Well, Alan Mulally and the Ford Motor Company are a very good example of a company that has now got it quite clear what they need to do. They know they need to produce cars that are cutting edge, that are fuel efficient, that are less polluting. But beyond figuring out what to do, he's really got to develop methods and models for delivering this across the business. He then has to make sure that all of his sustainability initiatives are aligned with the broader strategy of the company, of cutting costs, of driving revenues with new models, of really delivering on a quality and sustainability commitment to the customer. You've got to have metrics to track, and you've got to then be able to report on this to internal audiences and then to external audiences as well.
I don't want to sound like I'm disrespecting your academic insight, but you don't have to be a professor at Yale to know that sustainability is a big issue and companies have to pay attention to this.
You would be surprised how many companies are still in the posture of thinking somehow sustainability is a passing fad. But the broader set of concerns around water, both availability and quality, around chemical exposures, heavy metals, food safety, give this set of issues lots of logic as a core element of business focus.
What happens if a company doesn't get the sustainability imperative right? I mean, can you look back at the quality imperative or IT imperative and say, look, here's a company who blew it and look what happened to them?
We think there are a whole set of examples of companies that missed these prior business megatrends and have ended up on the dustbin of history as a result. Companies like Kodak and Polaroid failed to appreciate their businesses were going to be transformed by this shift to digital technology. And both of those companies have gotten themselves in deep trouble. Polaroid is, of course, gone. So if you don't see these business megatrends coming, it can restructure the competitive landscape and in ways that have profound effects, particularly for the current leaders who, if they're not on the ball, will fall behind.
Dan Esty is a professor of environmental law and policy at Yale University. He writes on the sustainability imperative in the May issue of the Harvard Business Review. Dan, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Great to be with you.
On University Avenue in Palo Alto, California, about as close to the heart of Silicon Valley as it is possible to get, there's a little two-story building not far from the train station. It's got a vegan cafe on the first floor. Otherwise, it's not all that remarkable. But for high-tech entrepreneurs, 165 University is legendary. Some of the biggest and fastest-growing companies in the world got their start right there. Some of the corporate tenants have had such good luck that they call it the Karma Building. With Silicon Valley starting to come back from the Great Recession, we sent Marketplace's Steve Henn to find out how good the Karma really is.
This little building was the birthplace of entire industries. The first portable computers were invented here. Some of the first smartphones were designed here. And upstairs, a couple of the biggest tech success stories in history got their start.
There are a long list of companies that used to be here. Everyone from Google, this was Google's first office, to PayPal.
That's Jack Abraham, cramped into his little office with six programmers and his dog.
Milo, stay here. Milo.
Abraham runs a tech startup named Milo. It lets you search local stores to find out what's in stock right now. For Abraham and other techies, this little office is kind of like sacred ground.
We have a pirate flag hanging over the main war column, is what we call it. My desk is where Sergey Brin once sat, who is the co-founder of Google.
To get his office space, Abraham had to launch a charm offensive. The owners are an Iranian family, and they own Medallion Carpet just down the street.
So I had to go down there, and I brought in some baklava because it was the Persian New Year. They're Persian, and they seemed to really like that, and they loved the business that Milo.com was in.
Abraham got his lease.
But in return, we have an option to invest in them.
Saeed Amidi is one of the owners of the Karma Building. Years ago, his family started accepting equity from promising startups in exchange for discounts on rent. The family invested on the ground floor of PayPal and Google and a couple others. They went from owning this little rug shop to becoming almost accidental venture capitalists. In fact, Facebook wanted a 5-year lease in the Karma building, and the family said no. That mistake cost them a fortune. But still, the Amidis are now worth millions, all because they were in the right place at the right time.
Why they say in real estate, location, 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 is because of the people who pass by there every day, the people who make the location special.
Now Saeed Amidi's trying to bottle University Avenue's magic and transport it to a 175,000-square-foot building two towns over, here in Sunnyvale. This huge space is called Plug and Play, and it comes loaded. It offers high-speed data connections. Lawyers and bankers are right here in the building. It has auditoriums, a cafeteria, and outdoor balconies. Music pumps through the lobby, and venture capitalists roam the halls. Saeed Amidi says he gets such a rush from this place, he stopped going to his old office.
You have an incredible number of smart, innovative people. They are all building their dreams. Their energy is transferred to me.
That energy is a powerful draw in a recession. Sunnyvale has lots of empty offices, but more than 200 startups have leased room at Plug and Play, and Saeed Amidi's invested in many of them. He's hoping for another Google, maybe two. But Judy Estrin, author of Closing the Innovation Gap, says recreating University Avenue's magic might not be so simple. She says the whole culture of Silicon Valley has changed.
The entrepreneurs tend to be more focused on how much money they can make out of a startup as opposed to being captured by the passion of a problem they want to solve.
Estrin says often in the new Silicon Valley, the startups themselves are the products, and selling these companies is the payoff.
There's more of a focus on what I call trading and flipping than building and creating.
What's missing, she says, are long-term bets on big new ideas or technologies that could change the way we live. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, indicator number 4,352, that the Greco-European debt crisis is scarily similar to our own experience with Lehman Brothers. Germany banned naked short selling of government bonds and some bank stocks today. I will spare you the actual technical details, but basically what that means is that people who want to bet, who want to invest, that stocks and bonds over there are going to tank are out of luck. The ban lasts until next March. It's almost exactly the same thing that regulators here did after Lehman collapsed, trying to prevent more damage to an already teetering stock market. We'll have to see how that one works out. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 114 points. That's about 1%. The NASDAQ down 36 points, 1.5%. The S&P 500 dropped 16 points, 1.4%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Ethan Lindsay on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abeed, and that's what you ought to listen to tomorrow morning to get the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this program, free food on planes as history.
When we get on board, we come to expect those silly peanuts or pretzels and that tomato juice. It's a way to pass the time, quite literally. And so the fact of not having access to this, that actually is a trying thing for any passenger.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.